Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Obviously, anybody who accepts a title like this evening's one is asking for trouble. It's really the meaning of life in 1 hour, which is obviously not going to happen. But it is an important question, and it's one that has played an interesting part in my own life. So I should begin by a little confession. I'm afraid for many years I was the kind of professor that you know only too well. I taught biochemistry and pediatrics, and the nutrition fitted into there. So I did medicine first and a PhD second, and then spent quite a long while funded by the Wellcome Trust, which was a lot of fun, and lived in Jamaica studying 10-pound two-year-olds before I came to the University of Ottawa. The good thing about the University of Ottawa was that as long as you have grants and you're publishing, the dean won't bother what you actually do. And so I would disappear to the philosophy department about once a week for the day. Because I had the grants and I was publishing, I could do that. But I did have to give lectures. I used to say to my good friend in the philosophy department, the only thing that ruins the university is the students. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get rid of them? And he agreed, of course. But I would walk in and give my lecture and walk out and really not care whether you'd understood it or not. You probably have the odd professor like that now, don't you? And that continued for some years. And then one man from 8 centuries ago got to me, 4 lines from the 12th century. They went like this. There are some who seek knowledge for the sake of knowledge. That is curiosity. Well, I'd done that. That's what a research scientist does. You play with very expensive Lego and try and persuade the world that what you've discovered is of some importance. It usually isn't. But at least it keeps you off the streets. It's rather like bioethics that keeps otherwise unemployable philosophers off the streets. And these things are useful. So I knew about that one. The second one is even worse. There are some who seek knowledge in order that they themselves may be known, that is vanity. From that day onwards, I referred to my CV as my curriculum vanitas, because that's actually what it was. I knew that the average scientific paper, even in the mainline scientific literature, is read by 6 people, including the referees. They don't read my CV, they weigh it. But I spent many years producing this thing. My curriculum vitae now is my 17 grandchildren. That's much more of a curriculum vitae, and one of which I'm much prouder. The third line is even worse. There are some who seek knowledge in order to sell it, and that is dishonorable. He wasn't talking about making a living. He was talking about making a killing. And as an academic, you can do that every now and again, certainly in the kinds of world that I worked in. Not all parts of the university are vulnerable to this. But every now and again, a pharmaceutical company would call and say, could I give a lecture? And being the cynic that I was, I always looked at the date of the lecture in relation to today's date. If the two were significantly close together, I knew that somebody else had promised to give the lecture and had now bailed out on them, and they were facing a great deal of embarrassment. The smart thing to say, if you haven't come across St. Bernard, is I don't think I'm really interested, at which point they double the honorarium. And you can then bid them up to whatever you want. And it's amazing how high they'll go rather than lose, say, the milk contract for a pediatric hospital, which they might lose. That is dishonorable, and I had done that. But it was the fourth one that killed me. Bernard says, there are some who seek knowledge in order to edify others, and that is love. And I was not guilty. I didn't even bother to learn the names of the less than 20 students that I would have in my fourth year honors biochemistry class. It was always less than 20 because I made sure that the first lecture drove enough away to get it down to less than 20 because I didn't like marking. And I also got better students that way. It's amazing how easy it is to get rid of students who are only interested in grades. If you make the first lecture one in which they have to think, they run away in terror. It works. So I had done that. I went home that evening and I said to my good wife, you know, the students that I teach now do not enjoy learning as we did. They're not having an enjoyable time. And then she said something amazing. She said, well, why don't you bring them home to supper? I said, would you feed them? And she said, of course I will. And so I invited my class, thinking they'd all turn it down, but they all came. Now my wife's a good cook, so we had a good meal. And then we started talking. Now we've had an interesting life. We've lived in interesting places, done interesting things. But to my astonishment, these young people from good homes had never had serious discussions about what they were here for. What is the point of you being on this earth? What is going to be a satisfying look back at the end of your life? How are you going to decide that? To my astonishment, they didn't leave till after midnight. That became a regular feature of that course twice a year, and they never left before midnight. Because your generation is, in fact, hungry for meaning in various ways, as I now discover. Because I left the university a little early because of things that were happening to me in terms of other opportunities, and I now give about 400 lectures a year and go around the world once each year, which is a wonderful way to finish your academic career, especially when you get to interesting places like Central Africa and Albania and India and Russia, and Cuba even. I go to Cuba quite often. And of course, in many parts of the world, people are worried about the future. And who wouldn't be worried about our society when you think about the killings that occurred in the Western world yesterday? There's at least two people who are deeply alienated from any sense of purpose and meaning. What on earth is going on? So that was the start of a turnaround in my life, because now I started to know the students' names and get to know them. The trouble with getting to know students is that shortly you start to like them. As long as you can keep them at a distance, you can avoid that problem. Because once you like them, they then start asking you to do things and you find it difficult to refuse. And that's the way I got to doing what I'm doing now, or one of the factors that led into that. Now, particularly in medicine, we realize that we're in trouble. We've realized that for some years. Most medical schools started a course in ethics somewhere in the last 15 years or so. When we started the one at our school, at the time we had a very nice liberal dean, a nice man, I liked him. And we were chatting at a cocktail party, and I said to him, it's very nice that you're starting an ethics course, but do not think that it will produce ethical doctors. And of course, being a nice liberal who thought that everything is a problem of ignorance, he didn't understand what I was talking about. And he said, what on earth do you mean? I said, well, ethics courses may mean that you have doctors who are also amateur ethicists, but it doesn't mean that you will get ethical doctors. The guy that you've chosen to coordinate this course, I know a little bit about. I'm probably the only member of your faculty who has lunch with some of the philosophers regularly. And the guy that you've chosen is technically a competent ethicist. He will do a decent job of laying out how people solve ethical problems. But he's also an honest man. He says, I only teach ethics, I don't practice them. Now, a few years later, he left the university in a hurry because at long last, one of his graduate students complained about his habit of asking them to sleep with him. Now, ironies of the university being what they are, a few more years after that, he came back to our university to assess whether our course was good enough. That's how the university deals with these issues. It's a problem, isn't it? Robert Coles has a lovely account of this from Harvard, where he taught a medical humanities and ethics program. And in one of his books, he gives an account of a young woman coming to see him. And she was from the prairies, And she'd got a scholarship to Harvard, but it wasn't quite enough to live comfortably on. So she was quite willing to do humble things to make a little money, and she cleaned rooms. And she came to Robert Coles with the following question. She said, I clean rooms to make my life in Boston a little easier. One of the rooms I clean belongs to a young man who came top in your course. Every time I clean his room and he's there, he propositions me. I tell him that I don't appreciate that and would he please stop, but he doesn't. How could he come top of your class? And Robert Coles had no answer and was honest enough to say so. It's a problem, isn't it? We all have a problem in this area. Now, the way that we have solved these problems in the past, of course, is different from what we're doing now. It's interesting, obviously I wouldn't be asked to speak to the Veritas Forum if at this stage I wasn't at least attempting to be something of an Orthodox Christian. And that is how I would describe my belief system now. I usually say I never had enough faith to be an atheist. You need an extraordinary amount of faith to be an atheist. I have a great deal of respect for them, because when you believe there is no God, which obviously you can't prove to be true, it's an act of faith, you now no longer have anyone to complain to. Because if you don't believe in God, there's certainly no point in blaming him for things that are going wrong. So you have to shoulder everything yourself. It's an impossible situation, really. That's why they're so angry at the moment, in many ways. But I could never bring myself to believe that. And it always looked to me as though something like the basic stories of the gospel had to be largely historically true. How else do you explain the rivers of blood that flowed to hold on to those ideas? And more importantly, how do you explain what happened? As one of my friends put it rather nicely a little while ago, he said, at the time of Christ, the Eastern Mediterranean was not some backwater, but the intellectual center of the world. And where Greek learning, Roman pragmatism came together, some fishermen, a tax collector, and a man who had a seizure on the road to Damascus persuaded their neighbors and then the whole Roman Empire that a dead Jewish carpenter was God. How weird is that? But that's what happened. And later, of course, he said there were these crazy Norsemen, and they were persuaded by an Irishman with a shaved head and his brothers after they'd killed him that they ought to lay off the slave women and be nice. And the monk won. How do you explain that? This friend of mine is not a Christian. He said, it looks to me as though I ought to read the scriptures, but it also looks to me as though if I do, I might end up being persuaded by the priest. He's resisting the temptation for the time being. But it's a fair comment, and I always like it when people who don't believe make my statements for me, because it takes the anti-Christian bias out of the responses. So that's a real world, and it's one that I grew up in, and then I came to university. And those of you who are Christian, you're now facing a very high probability that you will put your faith on the shelf in the next little while. That's the normal process. I actually listened to a man who I thought was the greatest preacher of the 20th century for quite a long while, a man called Martin Lloyd-Jones, sometimes three times a week, 3-hour-long sermons. I still remember many of them to this day, and people hearing me speak on occasions recognize that I'm plagiarizing him and come and tell me so. I usually acknowledge him, so it's not bad plagiarism, but rather a complimentary version. But he only got to my head, not my heart, because I was ambitious, and I went off in the academic pathway and put those things on one side. The church didn't help, of course, in that it's dumbed down in so many ways. And it was many years before I returned from that journey. Many of you are on that journey now. And some of you come from backgrounds which did not engage with the question seriously enough to help you through this process. But you will come back. It's what happens. I didn't realize what was at stake in many ways until much later, when my reading began to expand. And I think one way to look at it is that the Enlightenment was really an endarkenment. That's Alistair MacIntyre's term for it as well. And the reason it's an endarkenment is that it dumbed down our idea of what knowledge is. In the ancient world, you needed four categories to give a causal account of something, or at least Aristotle used four categories. And those categories have fancy names. They're called the material, the formal, the efficient, and the final causes. But you don't need to remember those. You can easily get it in your head with a picture. Just think about a statue. Now, the material cause of the statue, of course, is whatever it's made out of. Let's say marble. The formal cause is the idea in the sculptor's head of what could be made out of that marble. Michelangelo famously would release what he saw in a block of marble. The efficient causes are the skills and techniques and tools that the sculptor uses. And the final cause was the purpose for making the statue, to beautify the city. Now, the Enlightenment wasn't the turning point. It began much earlier than that. For convenience, you could put the date at 1277, but certainly in the 13th century. What happened about that time, in fact, in 1277, the Bishop of Paris temporarily forbade the teaching of Aristotelian deductive logic. That's arguing from the big picture to the little one, from God to us. They hadn't made a great deal of progress, except that the medievals could actually recognize an illogical argument, which I suspect many of you couldn't, certainly not formally, as they could. I won't prove it to you at the moment. You can ask me in question period, and I think I can prove it to you quite easily. But so the Bishop of Paris said that he was worried that Aristotelian logic might destroy the faith of the simple. So they were not allowed to use it. Now, I imagine that the profs went off to the pub, so to speak, and drowned their sorrows for a bit. But then they had got to teach in September, so to speak. And then one of them said something like this: "We can't use deductive logic, but we could use inductive logic. We could start arguing from the particular up to the general. That is not forbidden." Now, Aristotle knew about inductive reasoning, but he never trusted it because of his understanding of the world, his idea of knowledge and things tending to their rightful place. If that's your view, then an experiment can only teach you pathology. It can't teach you normality. So he didn't do experiments. But now, of course, what this led to, in a couple of centuries, was Galileo rolling a ball down an inclined plane and changing the angle and measuring where it landed. Now, that was the beginning of modern physics. He didn't know that was going to put a man on the moon, but it did. It needed two or three other actors to get in on the act to make it really work. In the physics area, of course, you had Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and Newton, all of whom, by the way, believed in God. It's not true that great scientists are always atheists. They aren't. In the long history, if you don't practice chronological snobbery, Christians win easily. But the two guys who we do need just to mention, of course, are Occam and Descartes. And you can add Bacon in there in each case. Now, what they said, particularly Occam, is you mustn't make hypotheses more complicated than they need to be. Of course, the problem is that real life is quite complicated. Simple hypotheses, like the Darwinian one, are not proving quite as good as one would like them to be as you go further and further down in molecular genetics, and it's getting more and more complicated. That ought not to be so. You know, when we first discovered that rice has three times as many genes as we have, that was the wrong way around. But our genes turn out to be much more flexible than those of rice. So they behave in different ways depending upon what all the other genes are doing and what the environment around them are doing. It's becoming extremely complex. DNA is, you know, that was 1953. Now we talk about epigenetic factors and all sorts of other things that change the behavior of that code. Of course, it's an amazing code to boot. Just think about it for a moment. I had this happen to me, of all places, in Cuba. One of those gifts that happens to you every now and again. As I said earlier, I've been to Cuba to lecture quite a few times on medicine, but they also allow me to teach pastors, as long as I don't push the envelope too much. And that's okay. And you can push the envelope quite a long way. But after one lecture, a gentleman came up to me and said, "Will you debate me tomorrow morning in the Department of Marxism and Leninism on the nature of human ethics?" Now, there's no way I would turn that challenge down. I had one evening to prepare, and I said my prayers and got various openings, because, of course, in a debate, the opening is absolutely fundamental. And amazingly, here's something the neurophysiologists can't explain. I also knew that none of the openings I'd got was the best one. There was a better one. And I was absolutely certain of that, but I didn't know what it was. How could I be certain? It turned out I was right. But it didn't come into my head till I had to walk the few steps from the front seat to here. And then into my head, whole was the next 10 minutes of the lecture, just popped in place of what was there to begin with. Fortunately, I had a Canadian-Columbian translator, because you can't trust Marxist translators. And I said, Hugo, I changed the start of the lecture. And he said, fine, what do you want me to do? I said, I want you to write on the board behind me, in Spanish, this message assembled itself. So he did. And then I asked the professors and graduate students and all the rest of the people there, if you came into the lecture room and found this written on the blackboard, could you make sense of it? And of course, this message assembled itself is a grammatical sentence, but a meaningless one, isn't it? And they all said that, and I complimented them on their erudicity. And then I turned around and crossed out message and put in DNA in place of message. And I said, but you do believe this sentence, this DNA assembled itself. Dawkins will tell you that. But don't you see, it's actually the same sentence. All that I've done is change the word message from Spanish to biochemical gobbledygook. But DNA is a message written in code specifying how to make you and me. Now, were you more right in your first assessment of the common sense sentence or in your second? And the audience burst into applause. I'd won the debate. Because they'd been living with scientism, reductionism, for far too long, and they knew that it had just been destroyed and the next 10 minutes would take it to pieces completely. It did. That was a marvelous moment. When we talk about the nature of knowledge, it needs to be richer, not thinner. And what happened, you see, with this changing, for the ancient world, the word fact was a richer word than it is for most of you. When you use the word fact, you usually mean, do you not, things that you can appreciate with your senses or with their extension in instruments. Certainly that's what they mean in the science faculty by facts. But for the ancient world, there were other things that were much more reliable than that. And Newton, in the introduction to the Principia, for instance, says, I feign no hypotheses, by which he means I'm not pretending to tell you the truth about the universe, I'm just giving you a model which happens to explain the data. Now, what we do in science is we build new models, new metaphors, if you like, and then we fall in love with our models or our metaphors. You can see that going on in our world at the moment. We attach too much significance to them instead of looking at reality. We do it all the while. I used to begin that first biochemistry lecture trying to get rid of people by saying that atoms don't exist. Now, these were people who've just spent 4 years on studying atoms at great expense, and here's a guy who says they don't exist. And some of them left, which was delightful. But you see, what I was saying to them is that the atom is a metaphor, a model of reality, which is good enough for us to make an antibiotic using that as the model. But it certainly won't explain quantum physics. It's a model. It's not reality. Models are always reductive. And that's what began to happen and why McIntyre, and I follow him, calls it an endarkenment. That's what it did to us. Now, within 100 years of these four men who believe, Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, and Newton, completing their work, you have Laplace, who's a practicing Catholic and perhaps the most rigid reductionist of all time, saying to Napoleon, when asked where God fits in his science, he said, Sire, I have no need of the hypothesis of God to do science. And that, of course, is true. Because once the methods of inductive reasoning had been shown to work, you did not need to believe what philosophically you needed to do the experiment in the first place to use them. They had been empirically demonstrated at that stage. But somebody who doesn't recognize the intellectual source of the tools they are now using is a technician, not a thoughtful person. you ought to recognize the way things came to be as they are. Now, 100 years ago, there were people, particularly in the States, arguing that there was a war between science and faith had stood in the way of science. Now, you won't find that amongst academic historians of science now. A few still say that. But my guess would be at least 90% of them would not say that. They'd be more sophisticated. They would say something like this. It is true that the church was not a perfect patron of science, but it was the only patron of science. That's where it began. That's where it had to begin, because that's the only place where the intellectual foundations were adequate to support the superstructure of science. And that is true. Cultures matter, and they are different. Hence pluralism, where we invite to the table all the different views, but not to say that they're equal, but to find out which is best. They all have something to contribute, but they are not the same. They are different. Any of you who is a bland multiculturalist, how many of you think multiculturalism is absolutely right? One or two. How many of you think it isn't? And the rest of you refuse to think. You're in the University of Toronto, after all, right? Either you do or you don't, or you're a nothing. You don't want to be a nothing. Well, you don't want to be wrong in public. You've missed a great learning experience, because it's a moment of great truth that you never forget the answer to. So whenever there's something you can't remember, you should ask the professor to ask you about it in front of 400 students. You'll never forget the answer again. It will be permanently imprinted on your mind. But I only have to tell you one true story to point out the limits of multiculturalism. A few years ago, I saw a little girl with a septic knee. It had been neglected. And by the time she got to us, she was dying of septicemia, and the knee joint had been destroyed. It just, the lower limb flapped around. Now, the only thing we could do to save her life at that time, because she got pus in the tibia and in the femur, was to cut off her leg, get the pus out, and fill her with what antibiotics we had. Well, I told the parents that's what we would have to do. And they said, we need to think about it. And I said, well, the OR will be ready in 20 minutes. Well, in 20 minutes, they said, no, we will take her home to die. And that's what they did. And I could do nothing about it, because I was a guest in this particular country. But I was upset, but I was the only person who was upset. The surgeon who would have done the operation was busy, he went to his next case. But the nurses, I'd just finished pediatric ward rounds, were not upset. And I said, may I speak to you? And they said, of course. Fortunately, I asked the right question. I said, what would those parents have done if this had been a little boy? And they said, oh, they would have done the amputation. I said, why would you treat little boys and little girls differently? And they said, in our culture, it is a woman's job to till the fields, fetch the water, cook the food, and bear the children. A woman with one leg cannot do all those things, so she will have a life not worth living. Now, if you are a genuine multiculturalist, you must accept that view of the relative value of little boys and little girls as being just as good as the one that is currently largely dominant in Canada. Do any of you? No, the multiculturalists have gone now, haven't they, at that level? And rightly so. In other words, there are good, better, and best judgments about almost everything, and we need to get back to that in the university. A woman was overhearing a conversation in the cafe at the Students' Union, I think it is, earlier this afternoon. And she didn't like it, obviously. I don't know exactly what it was that I'd said. I can be reasonably abrasive at times, I suppose. But anyway, she was overhearing a conversation. And she couldn't resist. She said, I find that offensive. And I said, I'm sorry you find it offensive. That wasn't my intention. Now can we discuss the truth or otherwise of the propositions? And she didn't have anything more to say. That's what we need in a university, isn't it? Now, of course, we're not doing that to you, are we? How many of you can say that you get up in the morning longing to get to school so that you can build an intellectual structure for your life of which you can be proud? There are no hands going up, are there? Especially if you're in the science faculty, what you do is memorize and dump, isn't it? You couldn't even pass the exam you passed with an A 6 weeks ago, cold. Now, That's not learning. That's inappropriate, especially at this stage of development of the Western world. I stopped doing information recall exams 20 years ago. I stopped for ethical reasons because I couldn't catch the cheats, and I wasn't going to allow my course to be used for cheating. It took me a little while to work out how I could teach and examine without using information recall, but I did, and it works. I still meet people who thank me for that course. You can ask me about it later if you want. But you're going to practice medicine, certainly with a computer on your desk or in your pocket or on your cell phone, which will link you to all the information in the world. That's not the problem. Information is there. The question is it true or false, and how do you evaluate it? That's the real question, and there's a step beyond that too, which is easily illustrated in medicine. You have information when you can pass the multiple choice instant recall exam. It has become knowledge when I can stop you in the corridor a few months later and say, I've just seen this child with these parameters from the intensive care unit. What do they mean? And you can explain it to me and what could be done. And it's wisdom when you know whether you should do it, or whether this child is going to die anyway and the right thing to do is put it in its mother's arms. Eliot saw this coming way back in the 1930s when he wrote Choruses on the Rock. There's a line in that which goes like this: where is the information we have lost in knowledge? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? Information without knowledge is useless. Knowledge without wisdom is dangerous. That's why it's very dangerous to go to hospital in July, just as the new residents have started. They need a little time to get things under their belts. The mortality rate is not constant throughout the year. So we lost our understanding in that two of the four categories I mentioned to you earlier cannot be measured. Cannot be quantified. You cannot quantify purpose, and you cannot quantify the idea that the sculptor has. But we cannot live without them. And I hope that all of you here tonight have noticed that the things that matter to you most in your life have that characteristic. They are non-quantifiable. Love, fidelity, truth, justice, honor. None of those things can be quantified, can they? Does that mean they don't exist? Not at all, right? I know, for instance, that your age group all hates divorce. None of you will argue with me about that. You may come and say my parents needed to divorce, but they shouldn't have got married in the first place if they'd had proper counseling before they marry, so make sure you guys do. So that somebody wiser than you can say, look, you're infatuated with one another at the moment, but you're not going to work as a couple. Get that sorted out. No, if you want to, there's never been a child that enjoyed the divorce of its parents. At long last, the American and the Canadian pediatric societies have taken their duties seriously and said that it's best for children to have a mother and father who care for them. The data shows that that is the best arrangement the world has yet found, and it's the only one that can provide love in sufficient quantities at low enough cost to be a meaningful approach. That's fair. You all know that's true. Those things, those immaterial things, matter. And note, they have an interesting characteristic. They go from falsehood to truth, from love to hatred, from honor to dishonor, from fidelity to infidelity. You can see that, can't you? That's unlike the physical cosmos. It's not changing in size. From day one, it has been the same. We live in a fixed moral cosmos, which we actually all know about. We are the first society in the world attempting to persuade itself that it doesn't know things that it does. It's never happened before, but we're doing it all the while. Let me demonstrate. I love doing this. I did it at Harvard not long ago. I asked a bunch of professors and graduate students, can any of you defend the doing of gratuitous harm to an innocent human being? Can any of you? No one wants to put their hand up in public about that. But if you are pro-choice, that's exactly what you believe is a woman's right. Because if you're not innocent in utero, you never will be. So that's over. It has a unique human genome. No one else has it. And that began at conception. And it certainly hasn't given its permission. And normally, you are very concerned about autonomy. So you're incoherent. Interesting. No response in Harvard. And I went on to the next one. Is any of you here good? Now, they were so stunned by the first question, they had no answer to the second either. Which I said, now you leave me with a real problem. I expected the clever postmodern answer, I don't know what you mean by good. But I came in under the radar, and you didn't say that, because you do know what I mean by good. And you've also told me that you're not doing it. Now, if you know what goodness is and you could do it, and you're not doing it, then you're some kind of charlatan. But if you know what goodness is and you find yourself incapable of doing it, then you are a slave to your passions. Which is it? And I moved on swiftly, of course, but the point was made. There are lots of things we know, and they're all in this area. We know that courage is better than cowardice. None of us like to be deceived. We might enjoy deceiving, but none of us like to be deceived. Nobody enjoys the divorce of their parents. Everybody knows these things. In other words, there is within us something that is deeper than we like to engage with. Now, I want to read something to you, simply because I can't say it as well as this. This is by Roger Scruton. Have any of you come across Roger Scruton yet? Somebody to look up when you get back to your computer. The paper is called The Return of Religion. Scruton is a very good philosopher. And he's writing this paper in part to explain why Dawkins and Harris and Hitchens and Dennett are so rude, which they are. And he says it's because they're in trouble. And of course, they're being trashed by their own side. Now, Nagel, Midgley, Flew have all said to Dawkins, for goodness sake, shut up, you're not competent in this area, which he isn't. But Scruton is. And this is what he writes. He says, the thing that we need to focus on at one level, at least, is consciousness. He says, consciousness is more familiar to us than any other feature of our world, since it is the route by which anything at all becomes familiar. But this is what makes consciousness so hard to pinpoint. Look for it wherever you like. You encounter only its objects, a face, a dream, a memory, a color, a pain, a melody, a problem. But nowhere the consciousness that shines on them. Trying to grasp it is like trying to observe your own observing, as though you were to look with your own eyes at your own eyes without using a mirror. Not surprisingly, therefore, the thought of consciousness gives rise to peculiar metaphysical anxieties, which we try to allay with images of the soul, the mind, the self, the subject of consciousness. The inner entity that thinks and sees and feels, which is the real me inside. But these traditional solutions merely duplicate the problem. We cast no light on the consciousness of a human being simply by redescribing it as the consciousness of something inside us, be it a soul, a mind, or a self. On the contrary, by placing that homunculus in some private, inaccessible, and possibly immaterial realm, we merely compound the mystery. It is this mystery which is bringing people back to religion. They may have no clear conception of science, no theological aptitude, no knowledge of the arguments, even though those arguments have come down the ages, and they have persuaded people that the fabric of contingency must be supported by a necessary being. The subtleties of medieval schools in these arguments, for the most part, make little contact with believers today. Modern people are drawn to religion by their consciousness of consciousness, by their awareness of a light shining in the center of their being. And as Kant brilliantly showed, the person who is acquainted with the self, who refers to himself as I, is inescapably trapped into freedom. He rises above the wind of contingency that blows through the natural world, held aloft by reason's necessary laws. The I defines the starting point of all practical reasoning and contains an intimation of the thing that distinguishes people from the rest of nature, namely their freedom. There is a sense in which animals too are free. They make choices, do things both freely and by constraint, but animals are not accountable for what they do. They are not called upon to justify their conduct, nor are they persuaded or dissuaded by the dialogue of others. All those goals, like justice, community, and love, which make human life into a thing of intrinsic value, have their origin in the mutual accountability of persons who respond to each other eye to eye. Not surprisingly, therefore, people are satisfied that they understand the world and know its meaning when they see it as the outward form of another eye to eye, namely God, in which we all stand judged and from which love and freedom flow. Now, it'll be worth your while going home and reading that three-page paper properly for yourself, because it's not one you take in instantly, is it? But I hope you've got the point that we are interesting beings, and I want to say a little bit more about that now. I often deal with this in what I call the four levels of happiness. And if you want to follow this in more detail, you can download an MP3 file for free from my website, which is just myname.ca. But is there anybody in this room who doesn't wish to be happy? No one, right? And if you did raise your hand, we'd send you to a psychiatrist immediately, on the ground that there's got to be something wrong with your head. But the problem is, of course, that your ideas of happiness have been trimmed down by the modern university and by the Dawkins-esque approach to scientism. And I want to enrich that view again. The easiest way to do this is to do it at four levels. So there's happiness 1, 2, 3, and 4. There's also an unhappiness 1, 2, and 3. But there ought not to be an unhappiness 4. How long after 7 did we actually start? 10:50. So I've only got a few minutes left before I have to stop. Is that right? Or is my clock wrong? Well, you can start fidgeting when you want me to stop. That'll be the easiest way. Okay, good. Well, happiness one I call animal happiness. It's the happinesses we share with the animals. Essentially, this comes down to food and sex. Now, currently I live on a farm and we raise Hereford cows. Now, these cows go to market weighing something. The last bull we sent to market had over 1,000 pounds of meat on him. Now, he could push down any fence I could build, but he doesn't. Neither do the cows. As long as they have food and a very occasional bull, the cows are no problem. And there's no disorder of the sexuality of cows. They're very straightforward about it, and they do it in public without embarrassment. Now, food is the same way. They have no disorders of food either. They refuel rather as you do. You ought really to be eating an entirely different way if you're to have happiness one. But humans, of course, can abuse both the good of food and the good of sex. The good of food you abuse in anorexia and in obesity, both of which are problems with controlling your appetite appropriately and having a proper vision of yourself. We don't do that very well. I've spent a lot of hours talking to young women with anorexia and making no progress at all. It is a mysterious disorder, but it's very real and it can kill you. So if you have a problem, go get help early before it gets a grip on you. And about 10% of first-year university women are actually already either starving or vomiting to control their body weight. That's bad news. Go fix it. Sex is even worse. What I'm about to say is so countercultural, of course, I was wary of trying it out. But I had a student sit next to me on an aeroplane. And you always try out outrageous ideas on aeroplanes. Because statistically, you will never, ever meet the person sitting next to you again. And they don't know who you are, and they don't know who... neither way round, you know one another, so it's fine. But you ought to do it on the first hub on the way out, but I did it on the way home because a student sat next to me. And we got to this point and I said, if you're like my class in the University of Ottawa, you're sleeping around. The problem with sleeping around is that shortly it becomes first boring and then perverted. And I expected an explosion of disagreement, but he was taken by surprise. It didn't come. Instead, he was stunned. And then after a minute or two, he said, I've never thought about it that way, but perhaps you might be right. Now, of course, a little further explanation brought out the fact that he was very sexually active, and of course, each relationship had been shorter than the one before. That's why they get down to one-night stands. It's the reality. And of course, when you get to that stage, then you start going to find books to get the excitement back, and then you get more and more kinky. Some of them absolutely horrendous, and I won't ruin your evening by describing them, but any physician who's done emergency in a large city on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday evenings could revolt you easily over the sexual perversions that go on. And the damage they do to people. As one surgeon said to me in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, my commonest operation at the weekends is removing shampoo bottles from backsides. It's amazing how many businessmen fall on the shampoo bottle in the shower. But that's reality. Now, the only way when you've got to unhappiness one, the abuse of food and sex, is to go up a level to happiness two, which is the life of the mind and the life of exploring the abilities that you have been given and the skills you've been given. That's what university would be about if Socrates had his way. And you would be getting better and better at what you do. But it's a better than thing, isn't it? You want to be top. And of course, if you want to be top, you soon get to unhappiness too, which is the anxiety that is that you might not even be fifth or sixth or even pass. So within weeks of beginning university, a large proportion of the class are already abusing drugs and alcohol to deal with their anxieties, which is unhappiness too, because we have lost our way in what learning should be. The only way out now is to go to happiness three, which is the happiness that you get when you realize that some things are worth doing intrinsically. They need no other justification. The best example, of course, is looking after small children, your own. Nobody can pretend that caring for two-year-olds is pure, continuous joy. But it is one of the most wonderful things you get to do, especially if they grow up into decent people. And they give you a little laughter along the way. You know, my oldest granddaughter is now 14, and I'm very proud of the fact that she's got into the National Youth Orchestra. But when she was about three or four, she wasn't quite the little girl she is now, and she was enjoying pushing over her little brother every time he balanced on 2 feet. My daughter saw her doing this and said, Hannah, I wish to speak to you. And Hannah, age three or four, said, I don't wish to discuss it. But that's a lovely moment, but she had to be disciplined, and of course, those things were dealt with. The best thing I ever did with medical students was take them with me to Central Africa while they were preclinical. And in one afternoon, I would train them to resuscitate a malnourished child. Then I walked with them for 1 to 2 days into the bush, and I left them in a village that I had chosen for them. And they were going to be there for 5 weeks. No electricity, no running water, a mud hut with a grass roof and a hole in the ground for a toilet. And they had to find and resuscitate 2 malnourished children and do a health survey of the village. They went to help. And they were helped. It was the most positive experience many of them have ever had. Doing good because it is good. And we all know about that. But of course, it's a need to be needed, love. In the end, we're all going to be useless, whether it's for 10 minutes or 10 years, depends on how we die. But unhappiness three is when it comes to an end. The only way out now is to go to happiness four. You're really meant to have all four levels all of the time. Happiness four I always do by telling stories, because they're not politically incorrect, are they? Everybody can tell theirs and other people's stories. And I want you to go and get the book anyway. The first one I always tell is from a colleague at Yale. Well, she was at Yale. She's now in Liberia. But she ran the pediatric oncology program at Yale for many years. She's about my age, but she's a single woman, but she loves kids. And like me, she grew up in a Christian home, and like me, left her faith behind when she got to university for many years. I recovered faster than her because she became an existentialist, which is a very dangerous problem. But if you're well brought up and you're also smart, you get promoted. It's inevitable. That's what happened to her. And she's running a pediatric oncology program at Yale. Now, she's a wonderful doc. She knows all her patients' names and their siblings and their hopes and fears. She runs support groups for mums and dads are going to lose their kids. You name it, Diane does it. But if you're an existentialist and you believe that life has no meaning, it's very difficult to talk to dying children. The only honest thing you could say is, this is absurd, I'm glad it's you and not me. That would be perfectly truthful and honest, but neither kind nor helpful. And she's a kind and helpful lady, so she solved the problem by never being there. But her mother kept turning up at the back of her head and saying, Diane, I didn't bring you up to desert people you love and who love you when they need you. You ought to be there. And of course, she gave in to her conscience in due course. The very first child she sat with was a little girl of 8 dying of leukemia. Diane had lost. She was sitting by the bed with the parents as this little child was fading away in a final coma. But just before she died, she had a lucid interval. This happens more in children than adults, but it happens in adults too. But this little girl suddenly sat up in bed, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, so to speak, and she said, Mummy, can you see the angels? Can you hear their singing? It's beautiful. And she fell back dead. Now, if that happened to you, apart from crying, what would you do? Diane was tough. It took 2 more children. She knew that she was not looking at a psychological aberration. She knew she was looking at something real for which she had no category. And she said, I was an arrogant Yale professor. So she was actually brought back by a little guy with an IQ of 80 and a beautiful question, which only children like that can do. I won't spoil the book. It's called A Window on Heaven, and her name is Diane Komp, K-O-M-P. If you're going into psychology or any of the social sciences, or you just have a heart, go get the book. You can get it on Amazon or whatever. It's published by HarperCollins. She's written about 3 books on the dying of children now. It turned her life around. I'm here tonight as well, and with this I stop, although there's many other things I would like to say, because of a Happiness 4 story. As I've said, like Diane, I wandered through the wilderness for a long while and was brought back by various means coming together. One of them was a patient. When I came to Canada, having worked with malnourished children in the developing world, I still had some questions I wanted to ask about malnutrition here. And I found a model in children with cystic fibrosis. 25 years ago, most children dying of CF were technically malnourished at death. They didn't look like World Vision pictures, but they were seriously underweight. So I wanted to know, A, could I reverse it, and B, was there any benefit? So I had to jump through the hoops to get ethical permission to do that experiment. The first volunteer was a young man of 15 who had the body mass of an 11-year-old. He was a farmer's son as well. He desperately wanted some muscle. So what he volunteered for was to be fed with a nasogastric tube through his nose into his stomach for a month with a chronic cough. That meant the tube went in and out 6 times a day at least. He never complained. About halfway through the month, one Sunday, the nurses called me and said, Stephen has just coughed up his tube again. If you want your protocol followed, you'll have to come and put the tube in yourself because we've got so many admissions we won't put it in till 7 o'clock tonight. So I went in to put in the tube. And I was wearing a suit, which I don't normally do. It was Sunday. He was a smart guy. He said, oh, you go to church? I said, yes, do you? It turned out he was Catholic and I was Protestant. And I was so well trained at not having faith as anything more than being personal that I said no more at that point. But he said something to his amazing mother, who was going to lose 3 kids to CF. And sometime during the next week, she said to me, you ought to speak to Stephen and your other patients about faith. You could do that. I have no idea how she knew I could do it, and I didn't. But at the end of the study, Stephen had got 600 grams where he wanted 6 kilograms. It was a failure from his point of view. But there was enough data for me to carry on. And to cut a long story short, we and U of T at about the same time put the first permanent feeding tubes into CF kids some 25 years ago. It's now a routine procedure around the world. And it works. It gives them a better end to their lives and a longer life. But I did go and visit Stephen whenever he came into hospital after that episode. I missed him many times, but some 4 years later, I was called to see him about the middle of the day. When I got to his room, he was clearly dying. And when I came in, he surprised me by saying, "Sit down, I want to talk to you." Because normally when you're dying of respiratory failure with CO2 levels climbing, you have a mild headache, you want somebody there, which his mother was doing, but you don't want to talk. But he did. And this is what he said. He said, "It says in the Bible, if you ask anything in my name, I'll give it to you. I'm 19 and I'm dying and I don't want to. What do you say?" Now, if you were the doctor, what would you do if some patient said that to you? If you were like me, you wanted to get out of there as fast as possible. But it wasn't an option. He was a friend. We both thought Monty Python was funny. I tried the ironic escape route and that didn't work. He was right onto that. So I had to work my way through the creeds. And of course, he believed in God, the Christian God. He believed that Jesus was the Son of God, that he came to die for our sins. If you confess your sins, you're forgiven. And when you die, you go to heaven. The problem was it wasn't helping. And I didn't know what to say either. So you all pray in situations like that and in foxholes, "Lord, what do I say?" And then into my head popped, of all people, Annie Dillard. Do you have any Annie Dillard readers here? One or two. It should be more. But you are too busy memorizing and dumping to read worthwhile stuff. Yeah. Anyway, Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek. It's actually a footnote I discovered later. But she says this: "Oh yes, God will provide for all your needs, but do read the small print. He decides what your needs are." And I knew what to say. I'd already pointed out to Stephen that by this stage there were children running on the ward who wouldn't have been walking but for his courage. And so I said to him, "Stephen, your problem is that like most Western people, you're misreading the text. I ask, God gives, but the key phrase is in my name. God will give, but he reserves to himself the right to decide what good is for you, not you. And he will only give you what he judges to be good. I think God is saying something like this to you: Stephen, you have done all that I want you to do. You have coughed enough. It's time to come home." Now the question is, both you and I know that barring a miracle, you are going to die in the next few hours. Can you also believe that that is the best thing that could happen to you? Now there was a very profound silence for a moment. And then he said, "Thank you, that helps. I think I can." And he did. Now his mother had not finished with me yet. She had not said a word during this interview that lasted about half an hour. But 3 weeks after the funeral, I got a note, which I still have somewhere, which began like this. It said, "It was ironic you were not allowed to give Stephen food for his body, but thank God you were there when he needed food for his soul." He had been asking that question of his priest, of his family, of his doctor, and they'd all pushed him away. They said, "You're not dying, Stephen. You don't need to talk about that." He knew that he was, and he did want to talk about it. Now, I don't think it would have made any difference to God's handling of Stephen whether I'd been there or not. That question and answer period was for my benefit and for his mother's, because I was on a guilt trip. I found very quickly there were other children who died asking the same question that I'd been involved in the care of. And I'd said, I'd not been there, not been concerned. I'd been practicing very bad medicine for a very long time. A medicine that does not take the story of meaning of a patient seriously is bad medicine. And this is not multiculturalism. This is pluralism. This is, if I have a Muslim, I need to get an imam involved. A Jew, I need a rabbi. Now, it may well be the very fact that I do that, they will ask me what I believe too. Because why would you not wish to share what is the greatest joy in your own life? What has been the greatest source of meaning? Both sides will want to discuss that. Serious Muslims, not the ones that are angry, but serious ones, want to know what the differences are, just as we do. The kind of PC silence that we maintain these days is no use to anyone. Certainly not in the context of medicine, because no one has ever seen or will ever see a multicultural patient. There is no such beast. Everybody inhabits a particular story which has to be taken seriously and engaged with. I have to stop, but this question period, those of you who wish to leave, you can leave. I'm quite used to that phenomenon. Those of you who wish to ask questions, please do. But thank you for listening.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.